is May the 17th.
May the 17th. This is Alfred Skondovich talking to Sharon Hollenbeek. Sharon Hollenbeek.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Right. Now what do I do?
The flavor of being sort of like the gossip of your crowd at the time. I mean, the way you saw things, the way, and things got around. I mean, they were like facts to you because so-and-so said it, or, I mean, it's that kind of thing. There's a lot of opinion and attitude. I mean, attitude toward your idea of the museum, what they were up to. This was what was shared by your friends. It's not like we're talking about what might be called objective events that have been, in some sense, put down someplace.
Yeah.
Is that right? It's like
what
it was like for you.
I was attracted to these people. And I had a reason to see, of course, Franz Klein.
Mm-hmm.
And it's amazing how a tragic situation, and it was not all a melancholy experience, I assure you. I had a wonderful time. As a matter of fact, the peaks of all this, like the accidents that are thrown at you, balanced everything out. It was worth remaining in New York. It wasn't worth being deported for alleged gun smuggling. I resent that picture of smuggling guns and stuff like that, you know. Sounds so vulgar and mercenary, which wasn't the case. It was really sort of a religious activity.
Yeah.
Okay.
But this was hanging over you.
It certainly was. And of course, going back to Mr. Scotty, young Scotty Middleditch, had it wrong when he thought that I was to be arrested for gun running. I mean, no one. It turns out I learned some years later that Scotty was very suspicious of people wearing collars and ties. You see, to him they were the polizia, the police. But this was really a fellow who was working at the embassy in New York, who I'd played cricket with, and he was on the county team that we had defeated. You see, and he just wanted to talk to me. And he's sort of angry and frustrated that I wasn't there. And all of this was misinterpreted by my manager, 16-year-old Scotty.
Well, how did you find out he was wrong? How long did it take before you learned after you for gun smuggling?
I exhibited with a Patrick Heron in New York. I forget the gallery. I think it was called the Sagittarius Gallery, which was above the Poindexter Gallery. And there were dignitaries there. At that time, the British government had a policy they had a cultural policy in which they were to emphasize paintings, you see. And Patrick Heron was there, and another guy, his name I can't think of, but I met him he lives in St. Lucia very happily, but I can't think of his name, a Scottish painter. And I presented works, drawings, to an embassy that was emphasizing British painters. See. And there at the opening, I thought, you know, no one can arrest me there, of course it's foreign territory, you see. And here was this guy, I said, my God, Michael Jarvis. He said, yes, I learned that you came in on the ship, and I went tearing down to the docks, and no one could find you. And I went back the following day, and you would jump ship or didn't come back. And so that's how I learned about this 3 years.
That was 3 years later.
Yeah.
So did you feel anxious? I mean, was that a part of your concern that you were kind of having to be careful?
Yes. The government in England, when I did this, the government was the Labour or socialist government, and they were hostile to the idea of Israel. See, they wanted to bring back the mandate which they had policed for decades, and they didn't want a Jewish state. They used gunfire and interdicted, or people who wanted to go there after the war. But the Churchill, the Churchillians, of course, Churchill lost the election after the war, were in favor of this. They supported this stuff, you see. Mm-hmm. And my brother became involved in, he was a champion boxer and a wrestler too. It's very strange that someone is a boxer and then becomes a wrestler. It's like a contradiction in terms, but he was very successful at this, and he was a promoter, and before the war he managed the Blackbirds. This was a trio of singing girls from Chicago who kind of preceded the Motown gals who came some decades later. So he taking advantage of the people that he knew, was not smuggling guns, but aircraft, fighter aircraft out of Great Britain. And I was involved in one scheme where I went to Geneva, and we went to this field where we were to gas up two planes. We go there in private cars, and the cars surrounding this field would provide the lighting, and the goddamn plane crashed, and we lost two great flyers. Two famous flyers. My brother had set up a mock movie scene at a British aerodrome. I think it was Watford. And there were glamour girls and people jumping in and out of airplanes. And the air ministry was charmed by all of this. And then the plane that we had eyes for was a Mosquito, twin engine, 400 mile an hour craft, which would have swept the skies over Palestine. We had a flyer for it, a guy named Burling, nicknamed Screwball. And Screwball Burling has the largest amount of kills in World War II for a flyer. He served in the Canadian Air Force in the Middle East, shot down about 37 aircraft. We were not professional people who maintain these aircraft, and someone forgot to do an altimeter check, you see. So when they landed, they didn't land, they crashed, you see. Now I felt terrible about that, losing two great men. The other one was Sergeant Cohen, who became famous for another incident. He was a non-commissioned officer who was flying an airplane that would really rescue people shot down by Screwball Burling out of Malta.
Now, this particular story is before you came to the U.S., is that right?
America? Yes.
It was involved, yes, with helping Israel.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. But this is, I think how we got on it was, yeah, I asked if you were anxious about while you were in New York, about being picked up for guns, because you thought they were after you for guns.
Yeah, I thought so. I thought so. But it's all the same. Well, there's no possible way they can arrest you. I mean, what, you know, only an American can arrest you on American soil. Anything else is a foreign country is not permitted to arrest their nationals on your soil.
Right.
But you don't think it through. You look at some panic-stricken face, you know, and a guy says, I'm getting the hell out of there, and you better do the same, like, right now. And, yeah. Okay. When the Labour government lost, and the new Prime Minister, Harold Macmillan, came to power, then they recognized the state of Israel, you see. So I was off the hook. And I have some things that will amuse you. I went to England alone to find out if there was anything, you know, legally awry. I'm traveling now under an American passport. See.
What name?
Skondovich. I've always signed my painting Skondovich.
Okay. See. When you worked, I know you used different names at times.
Yeah. Now I went there with an American passport, and I had the last guy I saw in England was a fellow named Ted Willis, who I designed sets for, and we were sort of involved in what young people get involved in politics, you know. I think we were very left-wing, and we worked at a left-wing theater. But now he entered the House of Lords as a Lord, Lord Willis. And I went to see him. I was required to dress in a certain fashion, stay in a certain hotel. I think the rooms are bugged, you know, I'm reading some. And the front desk, the people there chatter away to the secretarial people who serve the Lords. And when we look at the cable, we'll look at that tomorrow or some other time. He didn't remember the name, but then he remembered and said, yeah, have him come to see me now. And I went to the House of Lords, therefore, and was ushered into the gallery. Now, there's a public gallery, but there's a small gallery that seats about three people. And on it is what they call a woolsack. And I was brought to this part of the house by the rod. This fellow looks like Knickerbocker, the legendary New Yorker.
Charlie Knickerbocker?
Yeah, with the tri-cornered hat.
Oh.
And he has a rod of silver with an eagle on top of it. And I followed him, and he led me into this little box. And he banged his rod once, twice, thrice in the gallery. And during this period, every lord looked at me. And it meant that none had complaint against me within the realm.
Mm-hmm.
And I look for my friend, the nominating board.
Was that the purpose that you were there? Was to see if anybody had a complaint?
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah. And you'll read this.
How long ago was this? Roughly.
This was, I took an R&R, I was working on the pipeline, roughly
okay.
speaking. It was during the last year of the pipeline.
The 70s then?
Yeah. I went there, but we'll see the dates on
okay.
that. Anyway, then all of the lords look at you for, well, 3 seconds, you see. But it's an honor, really.
Yeah.
And then I looked, and here was this white-haired man who I remembered as being black-haired. And someone who was I really looked up to when I was 16, when I was up to no good with him. And I didn't recognize huge bags under his eyes, you know. And then the rod came back. He said, "His Lordship will see you now." And we were at the bar, and we went down to the bar. And there are other heroes I had. We all admire someone in politics, you know. You admire somebody, you idealize their life. And I always admired Emanuel Shinwell, who was a radical Labour member of parliament. And I remember his brand of rabble rousing, which I liked very much. And there he was under a table, ship faced drunk, under the table, out of the way. The chamber was brand new, actually. Here are ancient flags and pennants of the different lords from all of the counties and shires in England. And it's all brand new because 2 years before, this had all been blown up by an Irish terrorist. There was a garage below this building, and they have since dispensed with that. So everything was brand new, very plastic looking. That year when I came back, we went down to Harrah's, which is in, not Reno.
Las Vegas?
Yeah, we were in that state.
Nevada?
Yeah. Patty, where did we go in when we went, when we were at a hotel?
Frank Sinatra?
Yeah.
Reno.
Reno?
Yeah. Nevada, Reno, Nevada.
Oh. Well, anyway, as a surprise, Patty said, we're going to have dinner tonight at the House of Lords, and we want you, you say, I'm fresh back from this trip. So we sat down in the House of Lords
in
Reno.
Reno, okay.
And Patty says, how?
Oh!
And it's within the hotel complex, however. And she said, is this like the House of Lords? And I had to say it was more like the House of Lords than the House of Lords, because they'd been established for about 5 years and they had a patina on these Tudor beams. But the House of Lords that I was in, everything was brand new and everything looked plastic, you see. So I thought I'd keep my mouth shut about that and not destroy the illusions that people have. What's that lake that was there? I don't think it was. That wasn't Reno, it was some other
Crater
place.
Crater Lake is down, I think that's California.
Lake Tahoe.
Oh, yeah, right, that's right. It's a gambling place, too, isn't it?
Oh, okay, maybe it was Lake Tahoe.
Well, we were at Lake Tahoe.
Okay.
Okay, I'm sorry.
Yeah. Okay, where was I? This is apropos of what?
Well, I'm not sure. I mean, I think where we started was in New York about how you felt about.
Oh yeah, how I felt about it.
The first time you thought you were really being pursued, I guess.
Yeah, I've always been conscious of my weight because I always had a dream when you're. I actually have these dreams now, that I'm a prize fighter, you know.
Uh-huh.
And a campione del mondo, champion of the world, you see.
Mm-hmm.
And in dreams, I see myself under the spotlights and waving to the crowd, you know, held aloft by brothers who are so proud of me. Let's see.
Turn off for a second.
All right. When I arrived in New York, I had, in 47, I had four belts in prize rings. Mm-hmm. And I weighed 127 pounds.
How tall were you?
5'11".
How tall are you now?
5'9½".
You look a lot taller than me. You look to me like you're over 6 feet tall.
No, I'm about 6 feet. I think I'm, without shoes and socks, I think I'm 5'9½" or 5'11".
Really? Gosh, you seem so tall, and it's hard to imagine you only weighing like 127 pounds.
Well, my idol was Panama Brown, a great featherweight who weighed 118 pounds and was 6 feet tall. And he didn't look like a skeleton. He looked like some species of snake. And I always admired him. I had his photographs in England. I remember Panama Brown. Panama Brown was, I wound up in New York concerned by Panama Brown. And this is an amazing fighter who has the longest string of knockouts in the history of boxing, and invariably knocked the head out of people bigger than he was. Now, he was so efficient that fighters refused to fight him. So when this happens to you in that industry, you need a manager who handles exotics, you see. Like, the British had a heavyweight named I can't think of his name, but man would always wind up flat on his back. He seemed hopeless for a heavyweight. And so he needed a manager who handles exotics. And anyway, Panama Brown wound up, and so did this British heavyweight, wind up under the control of one of the best managers of exotics. That is, if you're too good or if you're too awful. In the case of the Englishman, the manager decided that the women loved him, and they would go to see him suffer or bring flowers and weep. So he had orchid nights to watch the Englishman, you know, hit the deck once again. So this is how an exotic guy, and the guy, this famous manager, this exotic manager, his name was Good Time Charlie Cohen. And when he looked at Panama Brown, he said, well, you're too good, my boy, and no one wants to fight you in America, but you are a champion of the world. And in Europe, they have little people, you know, the kids don't eat their food and stuff like that, and they grow up and they're very small, and you are their world champion, and they have lots of little people who will fight you. So he arrived in England and knocked out everybody inside, and he went to France, and his reputation preceded him. So he was the first one ever to go up the Champs-Élysées with a lion in a convertible. See, other people have done this.
With a lion?
With a lion cub that he would run around Paris with. Then he introduced boxing in Marseille. You know, Marseille is a cosmopolitan city. You think they would have boxing, but no, they had bullfighting was the big sport in Marseille in the 20s. And the municipal people wanted to ban it. And they needed something exciting to bring in. And they thought of boxing, and they had some good fighters, Kid Marseille and Kid Perrette. Kid Perrette from Marseille was related to me. He came from this Lithuanian village from whence we all came, and he defeated Panama Brown, became a world champion, did Kid Perrette. Well, anyway, he went down there and introduced boxing to the people down there. And unfortunately, he was so good that the bell clanged and he knocked out Kid Marseille. It was the fastest knockout in boxing history. And this infuriated the crowd. They felt that a world champion should, you know, humiliate the beast, and then eventually the animal will expire, but he should show all of his arts. This was totally misunderstood by Good Time Charlie, his manager, and he said, damn it, I think they're dissatisfied. And for the first time in the history of boxing, this world championship fight, they canceled that and began fighting again. And this time, I think he knocked him down in the first half a minute of the fight, but this time he knocked him out almost instantly. And then they realized that this was a mistake, that they were in a different culture. And there were 35,000 people to watch the debut of boxing, and they all wanted to lynch this poor guy. And they actually hid under the boxing ring and scurried out between the legs of all these people who were screaming and shouting. They ran into the town of Marseille, which kind of slopes down to the sea. And they ran and ran, and meanwhile, these infuriated boxing fans were joined by close to 100,000 people running through the streets to tear these people apart. They ran to the end of a pier, and there was a filthy little coal barge heading for England, and Good Time Charlie said, how much do you want for this? And he bought the boat, and they arrived safe and sound in England. Good Time Charlie, they went back to Paris to fight again, and he abandoned Panama Brown because he said there's an 8 foot tall Chinaman and he'd be a sensation and I want to lay my hands on him. And he disappeared into China. And poor Panama, who weighed 118 pounds, ballooned up in weight and became a drunk, and people would look at this human wreck and they'd say, yes, this is the former Campione del Mundo, look at him, what a mess. And people would buy him drinks. And believe this or not, Jean Cocteau, poet, writer, filmmaker, painter, said, who is that wreck? They said, that was the former Panama Brown. And Cocteau became his manager, amongst all these other things, and retrained him. He says, well, to teach boxing, one must study boxing, and he did. And he took him right back to the world championship. And then the war happened, and Panama had to leave France, and he died in New York. And I was the last one to see him alive. He was in this ward for indigents on Rikers Island. And this fellow weighed 118 pounds, now weighed about 60 pounds. And with this gaze, mask over his face because of tuberculosis. And became involved in the Panama was not represented in the United Nations except by the Swiss, and we asked them to give him a decent burial, and they did. And the Republic of Panama has instituted a pension plan for their fighters, you see. So if you ever go through the Panama Canal, you'll see a statue of Panama Brown.
Okay, now, how do you know all this? You tell it almost like you were there observing it.
Yeah, I knew. I went there. Went to Rikers Island and raised hell about it.
No, but what about the thing about fighting in Marseille and then how they had to run out of town and get on, you know, buy this coal barge? And stuff. How did you hear this story from someone?
Yes, it's what boxers tell one another.
Okay, that's important.
It's common knowledge.
This is boxer talk. Okay.
Yeah.
Good. All right.
Is that like in your books of boxer facts and all those books I always drag home? Is everything ever written in any of those books?
No, I don't think so. This is something I knew from childhood. And then to my amazement, when I learned that Jean Cocteau was his manager, and when you tell this to people, they kind of look at you and say, wow, oh, give me a break, you know, you're out of your mind.
Well, this started.
The reason why I got off on that, to explain, physically, the underlying anxiety I felt was, I weighed 127 pounds when I came to this country. Was examined and weighed and boxed at that weight. A year later, I would go through a plus or minus a pound during the year. I maintained the same weight, you see. A decade has gone by and I'm still at 127 pounds. The appearance I had was, you know, a scholarly poet or what have you, you know. Then I got my green card. And within a week, my weight went up 20 pounds. Within 1 week.
What do you attribute that to?
That for the first time, I didn't have antennas out, wondering who was a cop or in the immigration department. I used to always sleep on a couch down in Texas or at the Dr. Gray's house in Claremont, where I met all these guys that brought me up here. There I'd sleep on this back porch so I could, if anyone came to the house, I would actually come around the house and look who was knocking on the door. And I would be there looking at people at 2 or 3 in the morning. You know, guys would come home drunk or what have you. And so that's how I lived, and all of a sudden I didn't have to live that way. And all of a sudden my weight went up. When I came up here and met Patty, my weight went to a different plateau. I weighed around 165 pounds. And all the time I'm saying, well, I'm still fine as a middleweight. Or hell, well, I'm a welterweight now, but all this is in the past, you see. But you don't acknowledge this. You still want to go to bed thinking of that and having a wonderful dream. And then we went to Paris, and we rented on our honeymoon, we rented a vehicle from Hertz in Paris, and we drove down the Route Gastronomique, they call it, because the restaurants are 2, 3, and 5-star restaurants all along the way. And the food always amazed me. We would always order food, whatever we couldn't understand on the menu, we'd order that. And then a steak bon cuit, a steak well done. We'd always haggle over, you know, the unfamiliar thing because it looked beautiful, it tasted wonderful. And you'd get stuck with the steak or we'd have to share. But from Paris, here I am on my honeymoon, and down to the Côte d'Azur, for the first time in my life, I ballooned to a weight of 235 pounds. And I've had a struggle with that. That brought on high blood pressure and God knows what else. I mean, it
and
took us...
You were quite young at that time. I mean, you were... If yeah. On your honeymoon. You
right. 37 years ago.
And your blood pressure
was up? Yeah. I've had blood pressure, been treated for it ever since. Oh. And I'll go on diets to bring the weight down. Right now, I'm gaining weight. I weigh just over 200 pounds. But like the weight was constant at 127 pounds during, you know, in New York. Mm-hmm.
Like you kept in fighting trim or something in order to stay alert and stay on guard, stay ahead of the law or something.
Yeah. I mean, then there's... I can't understand, and there was an effrontery at what I would do. In California, the boys would have a liquor run, and they go down to Mexico, and for about $150, you could buy $400 worth of liquor, like fair trade value. Mm-hmm. Of course, it would be Mexican cognacs and stuff like that. Widow's Tears, that wonderful drink where if you want to keep drinking, you just... And you're hungry, you drink that, and so on and so forth. All these drinks and beer, which was good, and we go down there with $100 and come back with all this stuff. And there were about 12 guys living in Dr. Gray's house. He was on a sabbatical, and it was plainly my turn to go down there. I said, "Of course, yeah." So I go down to Mexico. I mean, going through the border, being. No passport, you know, and we went into Mexico, no problem at all. We got all the liquor, and then we came back through. When we go down there to get liquor, we wouldn't come back through California. We'd come back through Yuma, Arizona, because the Californian vendors were pissed at the idea of liquor, you see, and the state would impose a tax on you. About 17%. But if you come through Yuma, they wouldn't bomb you. But this is what happened. We arrived at, we were in San Felipe, and we ran into some professor who said he was being pursued by the Mexican police. And he had had an Inca head or some goddamn thing.
Uh-huh.
Some pre-Inca artifact, and he wondered if we could take it. He had a Volkswagen bus, and we this head was the size of this table, if you lower this leaf, and we put it in this Volkswagen. There was three of us: Professor Nice, he's a professor now, and can't think of their names. A fellow who actually acquired land up here. There was three of us. Nice.
You.
Myself and this other guy. I can't think of his name. He married the daughter of the governor of Baja, the Mexican governor. Cornell Hicks and Ben Nice. And I didn't tell them that, you know, there'd be a hassle with me on the border and I shouldn't go. But everything was routine, and my act coming into America was, I'm dressed like a Joe College character. very young, you know, the crew cut in those days. And now we have a Volkswagen with this huge stone head in there, you know, that you couldn't possibly avoid seeing. I don't know how we got out of Mexico. Like an idiot, some Mexican guy convinced me to buy a polyparrot, a parrot. And I said, no, I don't want a parrot. They create disease to the coast and stuff like that. And he's lowering the price. Now it was at $2. And I said, what if the, you know, the customs. So we rolled it up in this, those bamboo, and threw it on the ground, not a peep out of the bird. I said, okay, throw it in the car. And he did. And I forgot all about it. So we go to Yuma, and the guy puts his head through the window, and I'm pretending to be a drunk student, you see. And he says, gentlemen, American citizens. And this bird screams out an obscenity like, fuck you, gringo. And he says, okay, out of the car, out of the car. So I thought, oh my God, you know, why am I in this situation? And the bird was programmed to respond in this way to the customs people. And the bird went on a perch where he was quite comfortable. He'd been there before. And this guy would get part of the fine, to be exacted, from us. But no, this man didn't look in the Volkswagen. There was this huge thing.
He was all caught up about the bird.
Yeah, but not up on psittacosis, you see. Nice identified himself as a teacher, and Cordell Hicks, the guy was kind of leery about Cordell Hicks. There's something about the name that struck him, and he didn't want to mess with Cordell, and he didn't want to mess with me either. And the thing that was incredible, it may seem, he gave us a moral lecture. How can you bring a garbage mouth parrot like this to, you know, screw up the moral, you know, the right-wing parrots that we have in America, who all they want from life is funny when they crack or something like that, you know. And so we listen to this lecture from this high school dropout, and our heads are on our chests, or certainly mine was. Then we went out to the Volkswagen, we drive back. We had about $300 or $400 worth of liquor in there, and we started drinking it. You know, I certainly wanted something to drink, a lot to drink. And we drove up the coast highway in the wrong lane. This is at dawn, and the different police precincts would pursue us. We didn't know what was going on. We're chugging in this drink. Then the boys, nice.
You mean you were on the wrong side of an expressway?
Yes.
Or something
yes.
Like that?
Yeah. Yeah. And
you didn't meet any oncoming traffic?
We may have, but they got out of our way is all I can think of. They have a generous highway with, you know, what traffic would you, there would be traffic at 3, 4, 5 in the morning at the dawn, but not as much as you expect from a freeway, you know. People saw us coming, got the hell out of the way, but I don't know. I was too blasted.
Maybe they radioed ahead.
So we got off, but finally, notwithstanding the pursuits, and we got off in the small ocean town. I mean, what were they doing? They were calling the Scripps. There's this research institute that was supported by the Scripps people in Claremont, and there were girls there working, and we wondered if they would party with us, you see. So nice, that was his job, in this little phone booth. And then I became aware of police everywhere. The first time in my life I've seen police with drawn guns. And then I sobered up immediately. This was something I've been self-trained for decades, you know. And I thought, I have to save the situation, because Cordell was now foraging through garbage cans. And we had all exchanged our clothing for Mexican hats and these rubber-tired sandals and stuff like this. And Cordell looked like Pancho Villa in Mexican peasant pants. And I thought, I, poor son of a bitch, have to do something or we'll wind up in jail. And I was going home. And the police that surrounded Cordell, who was foraging through this garbage in this typical Californian alleyway, and I approached him confidently, and I said, that fellow is Cordell Hicks, and he will, they were asking him for his ID, which he wouldn't give. He was declaiming that he was a member of the starving masses, and that there, his day has come, and blah, 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 and all this Tommy rot. And I remember, I said, just ignore him now, and I flipped his credit card and threw him at the police. It was in his back pocket, huge string of cards. And the police, there was a lieutenant who had joined this thing. It meant he got out of bed to, this is from three towns back. And when they heard the name, it's obvious that they didn't want to do anything to Cordell. Cordell Hicks is an editor of the Los Angeles Times, but that's the name of his mother. Her name is Cordelia, but she uses Cordell in editorials and stuff like that. And that month, she was alone in the wilderness, demanding a pay raise for police officers, you see. So the lieutenant said, you'll handle this, won't you, patrolman? And he said, we're sorry, but we understand the struggle that has been done on our behalf, and we appreciate it. And we realize that they've driven him mad, but, you know, and good night, and take care of yourselves. So I thought, mother of God. No, the girls didn't want part and participle of us, and then we got back to, but I remember being shit-faced, drunk, I mean really drunk, and I thought, well, you better snap out of it, because you're going to wind up in jail, and you'll be, they had this camp for illegal aliens where it was situated in North Texas, they'd hustle you down there, so you wouldn't have some, your own glib attorney, you see, who knew your case. And so yes, that was an anxiety that would sober me up very quickly, you know, and that kept my weight down, you know.
Right. Major motivator, I mean, that would affect you waking and sleeping, that you were an illegal alien. I mean that, but I wasn't really sure, because you know how it is, it's like when you have a headache sometimes, you forget all about that because of you're doing something, and in your memories later, you don't remember that underlying pain.
It was terrible, and yet it was a great motivator. You know, I look at my son, and he's nervous. He makes a lot of noise. You go in their house with their children, and you see his nervous energy. And I thought, my God, that's what I was like. Mm-hmm.
Does your son live here in Fairbanks?
He used to live here. Now he lives in Anchorage. They have a little girl who needs the hospital facilities down there. She's much better now. Pretty little girl. Where's her? Oh, well. She looks exactly like Patty. But I. What happened to the photograph of you and our little.
Oh, Shelby?
Shelby, yeah.
How old is she?
She's two.
Two.
Well, actually,
yeah.
She's two in September.
Yeah.
Oh, she's going on three.
Yeah, she was prematurely born, but she's doing much.
She was so much premature.
Yeah,
wow.
Take a look at this.
This is Mitchell. That's their son.
Yeah.
Oh, gosh, what a doll. Well, he looks like you, too, that smile. Yeah.
No, you think he looks like her.
Oh,
look at this. This is outrageous.
Oh, yeah, outrageous.
Yeah,
that's darling. God.
She has trouble. She has to have those nose hole things on.
You know,
yeah.
For breathing?
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. There's a little tube that follows her around.
Yeah.
So that's going to be fixed eventually?
Yeah. They've
said
a couple months that should be coming off.
Well, she looks great, doesn't she?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a great of you too. My gosh, you sure don't look your age in oil. That's great.
Oh, by the way, you gotta leave.
I was an illegal alien. This sounds like the title of a movie, you know. But I ran into the Kooning, who arrived here in the 30s, had jumped ship, you see. And he was a totally dysfunctional man, was de Kooning. And I kind of inherited his lawyer, Lawrence Siegel, you see. And so I thought, he says, you don't have to worry about it. He says, the art world is like a family. No one will pick up the phone and inform on you, you know. You're safe with us, you see. And so it's the fact that no one ever did this, notwithstanding the jealousies, you know, the sexual divides and competition between men and men, men and women. No one ever did anything like that. So I felt safe when I was in New York, you know, not unconditionally safe, you know, but
but you felt pretty good in New York.
I felt pretty good. I thought I'm where I belong, and, you know, and de Kooning was sort of the king of the art world, you know, and is with a monumental talent. And I thought, and he had jumped ship here, you see. And there are all these things to protect him that emanate.